From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts slows the growth of healthcare costs while the healthcare wars in Washington continue. We'll hear from Congressman Joe Kennedy III.
If I could give Republicans unsolicited advice here, it would be healthcare might be something that not a whole lot of people think about until you need it. But when you need it, it's the only thing you think about.
Also today, the Black Gods of the Asphalt, a story about religion, hip-hop, and the hard basketball courts of Roxbury.
You have to protect yourself from the violence. And so the court represented a place of safety where I felt like I was a human being, where I felt love.
Plus, the premiere of Stronger, a film about marathon bombing survivor Jeff Bowman. And the Cleveland Indians keep on winning.
The Indians have won their 20th consecutive game.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
They have tied Oakland for the American League record for the longest win streak.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll start today with health care. In Washington, lawmakers have rolled out two radically different proposals. One came from Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who introduced a Medicare for All single-payer bill. The other from Republicans, who are trying one more time to roll back the Affordable Care Act. And here in Massachusetts, some progress as state regulators say the growth of healthcare spending slowed somewhat last year, even more than they'd expected. So let's say hello to health policy guru Stuart Altman. He's chair of the State Health Policy Commission and professor of national health policy at Brandeis. And Stuart Altman, always good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Andy.
So let's talk a little bit about what happened in Massachusetts. So a 2012 law set a target of 3.6% growth in healthcare spending. Last year, spending rose 2.8%. So that, I want to dig into the numbers, but overall, that sounds like good news.
It is good news. And I think our health system ought to feel proud of what they've done, both our plans and our delivery system. It's a very good number.
So if there's one or two or three things on the top of your list that explain this modest slowing in healthcare spending, what are they?
Well, first, pharmaceutical spending, which has been a big source of the growth, both here in Massachusetts and around the country, did slow a bit. I mean, it's still growing over 6% a year, which is greater than our income or our prices, but it's much lower than the 12% that we had a couple of years ago. So that's one of the reasons why it. Second is that some of the, we've sort of stabilized our insurance market a bit in terms of people joining the connector or the exchanges. And they are selecting lower cost plans, which means that their growth rate is below that of most other areas. So those two, among others, but also our inpatient hospital costs are not growing as fast. We have less people using the hospital, which is mostly a good thing. We have outpatient care growing, which could be a good thing as well if it keeps people out of the hospital. So overall, the 2.8 is a good number, but I do want to emphasize that it doesn't mean that we've solved the cost problem.
Right. We're not ready to declare victory and go home, in other words.
No, I am definitely not prepared to declare victory. I'm prepared to say that we're making progress.
Right. So affordability, still some of the highest healthcare costs in the nation, and people are paying a little more out of pocket. Is that right?
Yes, they are. And that is an issue that you could look at that in a positive or negative way. From an economic point of view, when people pay more, they are more concerned about what they use and what they don't use. And so economists in particular have been saying that that's actually a very good thing. On the other hand, from the patient or from the insured, the idea that they're paying a higher percentage of the medical bill themselves is a problem, and it's particularly a problem for lower income populations where this cost sharing could be a real financial burden.
Yeah. Speaking of that, so I'm looking at the information about premiums. So premiums for individual purchasers declined a little bit, 3.4%. premiums for employer-sponsored insurance rose by almost 4%.
Well, we need to be a little careful on these numbers. One of the main reasons why the individual market declined is, well, there are really a few. One is that as you take on younger, healthier people, the average is going to decline because you have younger, healthy people coming in, where the ones who signed up in the beginning were sicker. So that's one reason. The other is that more people in the individual market are selecting these limited or tiered network plans, which are and they look closer to like Medicaid Plus, so that they have they often pay the providers lower rates, and so all told, the numbers are lower, and that's a good thing, but there are reasons for it, and it's really not fair to in a way to compare the individual market to the bigger employer-based market.
Yeah. So what's, in your view, we've seen this decline from these numbers over last year. What's the challenge ahead, in your view, to continue that forward momentum?
Well, first of all, I'm very pleased with the number, but I'm also very chastened. You know, if you look over the 4 years, we started out at 2.3 1 year, and then it jumped to 4.8 the next year, and then it went down. So what I look at is more the overall trend, which overall is good. It's slightly under the benchmark of 3.6. It's actually 3.55, which is about the same. We're on target, but I don't look at 1 year. The other thing that is worth looking at is to compare what we're doing here in Massachusetts with the rest of the United States. And there, I think we should take some comfort. Our growth rate, we used to be the most expensive state in the United States. And while it's nice to be number one, in this case, I didn't think it was so nice to be number one.
Right.
And we're still high. And there's some good reasons for us to be high. We have some of the best, some would say the best medical system in the country, if not the world. But the idea that we could find areas for savings is also real. Now we're no longer number one. I think last year we were number four. And our growth rate is significantly under the national average. So I think we're doing things that are right. And I really want to give credit to the payers and the providers in our state. I think they're the ones that are stepping up to the plate.
Stuart Altman, let me ask you a little bit, at least one question about what's going on in Washington. We mentioned that Bernie Sanders, the former presidential candidate, is rolled out a single-payer government-run insurance program today. The bill, of course, has sort of next to no chance of passing, but the Democrats are sort of happy. Some Democrats are happy to engage in the debate. Meanwhile, Republicans are making one more effort to roll back parts of the Affordable Care Act. I guess my question to you is, how does this uncertainty and this continued set of debates in Washington affect what happens here in Massachusetts?
Well, there's no question this uncertainty is not a good thing. We just finished a commission meeting where we had the major payers and some of the major providers. And after the meeting, I was talking to a few of them. The payers are very nervous. They really don't know what next year is going to bring for them, particularly those payers, those insurance companies that are in the exchange. It's all well and good for insurance companies to be tough, but, if they lose lots of money in the exchanges, they're just going to go out. And now we've been fortunate in the sense that our plans have been willing to play, and the connector is doing a great job. But the uncertainty is really not good at all, and I would say it doubly for our major health systems. They're being asked to make long-term decisions with respect to who they hire and what they invest in and so on. And if they don't know what the system's going to look like a year or 2 years from now. It's very difficult. So this uncertainty is terrible.
All right. Well, that's Stuart Altman. He's a professor of national health policy at Brandeis University and chair of the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission. Stuart Altman, thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, healthcare was where I began a recent conversation with Congressman Joe Kennedy III. I met the Newton Democrat down in his Washington, D.C. office, and I began by asking him about the Republicans' failed efforts to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, and if he thought the latest Republican effort being rolled out today would also fail.
I certainly hope so. And I think that's what not only folks from Massachusetts want, but I think it's what the country wants. Look, we've been under these debates around health care for months, if not years. And despite multiple attempts by Senate Republicans to try to actually repeal the Affordable Care Act and end up taking health care away from millions and millions of people, American public said, no, you can't do that. We don't want you to do that. From my perspective, anyway, the system actually worked. People stood up, they spoke out, and they said, no.
I agree with you that, from your perspective, the system worked because it's intentionally difficult to sort of dismantle laws, and this sort of proved that point. On the other hand, the reason why this failed was because the folks who wanted to dismantle it were divided between folks who wanted to dismantle it and folks who really wanted to dismantle it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. No, yes. From somebody that had a very up-close view of this. I think what you saw writ large, though, big challenge is that our Republican colleagues ran into was that their proposals actually didn't address the challenges that many folks had with our healthcare system. Nobody said that the problem is that one, Medicaid is too expensive, and two, that Medicaid pays doctors too much. There's challenges out there. No one ever said that. The bottom line is, behind closed doors, I'd have this conversation with some of my Republican colleagues too, is to say, look, let me tell you how well it's going to work when one party has sole blame for the challenges in our healthcare system. And if you wonder whether that's a good thing, look at where Democrats have been for the past several years. When it's somebody's loved one that is in a hospital bed or is being rushed in an ambulance to get the care that they need, if it's somebody whose child is diagnosed with a serious illness, and all of a sudden the question is, wait, I can't get the care that I need, or I can't afford it, or my insurance isn't going to cover it, or something else, there's some block to me for me to get the specialist I need. And that's because Republicans crafted a bill a certain way. If I could give our colleagues any unsolicited advice here, it would be healthcare might be something that not a whole lot of people think about until you need it. But when you need it, it's the only thing you think about.
I want to ask you about the big news last week about DACA, President Trump's decision to end DACA, and that would have protected young immigrants who were brought here illegally as small children from deportation. Trump now says it's up to Congress to fix it. Will this provide the impetus for Congress to act, in your view?
So first off, it was a terrible decision for the president to make, to tell Americans, make no doubt about this, they're Americans. They are part of the fabric of our country and our communities. The president of the United States decided to say that they're not wanted, and he didn't have to do it. I struggle to understand how somebody could think that a good day for America is somehow where you jeopardize the bonds of 800,000 families across this country, but that's what he did.
I mean, I guess if you sort of look for a justification, I mean, the Trump administration has suggested that DACA was on sort of shaky legal ground. It was being challenged by attorneys general from several states. So basically kick the can over to Congress and say, hey, guys, it's up to you to sort of make sure this is legal and right. Put it right.
That's one way of looking at it, obviously, and understood. Two, he could have extended DACA. He could have also come up with his own plan and urged his Republican colleagues to sign on to it and engage Democrats in that process. He didn't. He tore the rug out from underneath 800,000 families and then kicked the can to Congress so that he wouldn't get blamed for it. And I think that's shameful. Will this spur Congress to act? I sure hope so.
I'm sure you're hearing from Dreamers back in Massachusetts from your district. What's your message? What are you telling them?
We're going to fight for you, that this is your country too.
I'd love to ask you sort of a big picture question about sort of where Democrats stand in this particular political moment. Past 8 years, it's been rough for them, for you Democrats. Lost the Senate, lost the White House recently, governors, mansions, legislative seats all over the country, something like 1,000 in all or something like that. I mean, I guess the question is, what happened? What happened to your party?
Look, I think on the one hand, politically, yes, obviously those numbers are accurate and it's been a rough couple of years. On the other hand, we've also seen a dramatic progression of some of the core democratic values that I think many of us hold and the country holds dear, right? Whether that's a progress that's been made on LGBT rights and gay marriage, the progress that we've made on healthcare, to see the American public stand up behind it and say, hey, wait a minute, you can't take that away from me, my family, my neighbor. You know, there's some consolation there in the fact that the issues that we've been fighting for have actually taken hold and I think are valued by the American public. But politically, no doubt, we all have to take a good look in the mirror and say, is this really where we want to be? And the answer to that is no. There's a lot of lessons to take from that 2016 election, but one of them is that there's a lot of voters out there that decided to vote for a guy that was going to shock the system.
And I think, so what's the answer to that? I mean, what do you think the answer to that is?
So I think one is we, again, have to acknowledge that there's a, I think, across the country, and this often gets framed as kind of a working class white issue in the Midwest, and I think it's broader than that, right? It is, though, a recognition that there's a real economic uncertainty that millions and millions of American families are confronting, where this country for an awfully long time had a system that created opportunities and jobs that would provide for a roof over your head and food on your plate, put your kid in a good school, and allow you to save for a decent retirement. And that's not the case now for an awful lot of people.
I mean, we've been talking about this for a long, long time. And what I'm having trouble understanding is, you know, this used to be the sort of Democrats' bread and butter. Why is it no longer sort of Democratic bread and butter? Or what do the Democrats have to do to convince those folks? How do you get them back?
So I think it's a combination of things. And one, I don't think the Democratic Party necessarily wholly left, but I do think that, look, part of this is that we were a party that was in power because of the situation that President Obama found himself in when he did come into office and the precipice of the worst economic recession in generations, something that could have been far worse. He and Democratic leadership at that point actually had to do some things that were going to be really unpopular. Bailout was really unpopular. Bailing out Wall Street was really unpopular. But they had to do it, and they did it, and we paid a huge political price for it. But it was the right decision. And I think because Democrats decided to do, I think, what we thought was right, what we've been trying to do for an awfully long time, my uncle was working on trying to ensure that everybody had access to quality, accessible health care in this country for over 50 years, and he never even got a chance to see it. And so we leveraged that opportunity to try to make that so, and paid a political price for that now, which 10 years later, people are actually standing up for and fighting for. It does mean, though, that just because those folks that are in office or aspire to run for office believe something doesn't mean that the folks that you seek to serve necessarily believe you. You got to go out there and earn their trust back. And that's long and that's hard, but you got to scrap and scrape and claw your way back to it.
I just want to ask you in general, is this a particularly tough time? I mean, you're a relatively young congressman. You're at a time when it's really got to be kind of hard to be a Democrat. Or do you not look at it that way? Does the fact that your family has been in this business so long, you have that advantage of understanding that you got to take the long view?
I think it's a tough time to be in elective office. I've got a number of Republicans friends down here. I count them as friends. I think many of them feel similar frustrations. I don't think that's so much a Democrat or Republican thing at the moment. But I think, you know, you do feel our system isn't working very well at the moment. The vast majority of people here, my colleagues here, believe it or not, are actually pretty decent folks. But the system's in a tough spot at the moment. And that part is frustrating. And obviously, we're seeing now with a Trump administration a targeting of some of the core values that I hold most dear, and I think many residents of Massachusetts hold dear, where you try to find ways to unite people behind a common idea and push the country forward, rather than play to some of the worst base instincts pull our country apart, which I think, unfortunately, the president has done, and some of those around him have done deliberately and, unfortunately, very effectively. So that part's heartbreaking. The way we get through it is you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you keep trying.
I want to ask a little bit about your long-term view. I read recently that you spoke openly about, yeah, maybe one day a Senate seat would be right for Joe Kennedy. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how you view your long view in this business?
The best way that I have learned anyway to try to understand this business is to know that one lesson from my father-in-law, who happens to be a minister, who said, "We make plans and God laughs." So
that wasn't God laughing. That was me. Sorry about this.
So the bottom line on this, and I, you know, and appreciate some of the speculation on what my future might be. I count Senator Warren and Senator Markey as close friends and mentors of mine. You might know I met my wife in Senator Warren's class. Senator Markey has been a dear friend to me and my family now for an awfully long time. So
So if one day you end up running for Senate, you're not going to be running against them, is what you're saying.
I'm not going to be running against them. And I think they're going to be there for a while. And I want them to be there for a while, unless either one of them has aspirations to lead in another capacity, which may or may not come to pass as well. But I'm big supporters of both of theirs. So beyond that, I don't know what I'm doing for dinner tonight. I do know that I've got wonderful, amazingly perfect 20-month-old daughter who's going to be hopefully joined by a little brother in another couple of months. I've got an incredible wife that puts up with me and a growing family and an extraordinarily demanding travel schedule and job. I don't know what the future is going to hold for me. I do know that try to meet the responsibilities that the voters of the 4th District have placed on me, and I do the best I can every day to try to do them proud.
All right, that was Congressman Joe Kennedy III. He's a Democrat who represents the state's 4th Congressional District. We caught up with him recently in his Washington, D.C. office to record that interview. Stay with us. There's more ahead coming up, Finding Religion on the Basketball Court. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We want to listen back to the powerful story of Onaje Woodbine, who was here a little over a year ago. Woodbine grew up poor in inner city Boston, learned basketball on the hard courts of Roxbury, and ended up playing for Yale, where he was among the best in the Ivy League. Then during his sophomore year, he quit because he wanted a life of the mind, to get away from a system that valued young black men as profitable athletic workers. That led him back to the basketball courts of Roxbury, to a doctorate of philosophy at BU, then on to Phillips Academy in Andover, where he teaches philosophy and religious studies. Onaje Woodbine wrote about his journey in his book, Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip-Hop, and Street Basketball. When we spoke to him last year, I asked him about the role basketball played in his life as a young man.
Yes. So, you know, when I was 12 years old, I lost my coach and mentor who was like a father to me. Early on, I didn't have a father in my life. Later on, we reconnected. But during those early years, I really, you know, needed a male role model in my life. And he was really the person who stood out for me. And he passed away. He was in a car accident. He was a police officer, Boston police officer, and he lost his life that day. And, you know, I went to the basketball court to sort of find him. You know, I remember the next day going to the court and shooting around and you know, I was asking myself, what happens when you die? You know, where do you go? Where is Manny? And, you know, the court was the place where I felt most comfortable asking those kinds of questions.
Now, why is that? What did the court offer you at that time?
Well, you know, in the streets, as a young black man, you have to have wear a certain mask. You know, you have to look tough. You have to walk with a certain style that is really, you know, a false. You get a false sense of self living in the streets because you have to protect yourself from the violence. And so the court represented a place of safety. It represented a place where I could question, where I felt like I was a human being, where I felt love, you know, from my peers. So I think it was just a natural place for me to share those emotions of pain and grief and to ask those kinds of, you know, deep human questions.
And in your case, at that point in your life, it was also a place where you could express a certain amount of athletic talent and identity, right?
Well, definitely. You know, growing up in the inner city, there are three sort of identity options for young black men. There are others, but, you know, the main ones are either you're a ball player, a rapper, or a gang member. And, you know, I was blessed to be able to have the talent to play ball because the gang members would leave you alone. They'd give you a pass. They, you know, they'd say, you know, this young man, he represents the hope of this community. And so we don't want him to participate in the violence. So to have that talent and that identity, it meant everything. It meant the difference between life and death for me.
Yeah. So you end up making this remarkable journey from the hard courts of Roxbury to Yale University. And what's striking about what you write about that experience is you were a star. You were successful, as we said in the introduction, by many measures, you were living the dream. But you encountered some dramatic disappointment there.
Definitely. You know, I reconnected with my father when I was 15 years old, and he taught me that I already had everything I needed within me, that all I had to do was listen to that still small voice. And I carried that with me on the court. The basketball game became a moving meditation for me, and I carried that to Yale. And it was shocking to me that coaches and, you know, athletic administrators didn't value that, that they didn't encourage that or seek to cultivate or foster that kind of self-exploration amongst athletes. You know, we were treated like laborers, and, you know, we were there to work, and, you know, it was like a job. And at Yale, you know, the reason why I went to Yale was because I thought they would foster the life of the mind and the body. And I discovered that, you know, the body was emphasized over the mind.
You wrote something that really, really struck me about this particular topic. I'm just going to read it. Even though my inner city coaches were often less educated, they saw hoops as an extension of our lives in which players' deepest thought and everyday struggles played a significant role. How ironic it was then to discover that one of the greatest institutions of learning in the world, coaches built a tacit but impenetrable wall between athletics and the life of the mind.
Yeah, it's
so beautifully expressed and so sad and disappointing.
It really was. I mean, the word coach was sacred, you know, where I came from. That was the person who told you, you know, if you don't do your homework, if you don't read, you know, your papers, you can't get on this court. You know, you know, this game is meant to elevate your mind and your spirit. And so to find that, you know, at Yale, you know, we practice for 4 hours a day, that, you know, we never discussed issues of dealing with either society or the life of the mind or character. It came as a huge shock to me, and particularly when I discovered a lot of misogyny and racism in the locker room. You know,
Not to mention racial division.
Racial division as well. Mm-hmm. Many, you know, the white players, most of them, especially my first year, were in a fraternity which none of the black players belonged, and there was silence on racial issues. And it was quite depressing to realize that the game that I had loved and given all of my heart to had become a corporation.
Mm. And it's quite striking, too, the way you describe sort of the role of talented black males within this corporation, that they're sort of seen as essentially black athletic workers.
Well, certainly that's the myth of slavery, you know, that sort of black men are extremely sound in body, right, that they have this almost primitive athletic ability, but that it comes along with a defective mind. And, you know, I think that racial myth does push these young men to the court. Poverty does push, you know, young African-American men to the court as well. But, you know, my thesis is that once they arrive there, there's agency. Right. Mm-hmm. They're moving their bodies with each other, and they're gaining access to a mode of release from the culture. So it's this paradox.
Yeah. So you decided to quit, and I gather this was probably shocking to your coaches. And there's quite an amazing story about the reaction of one of your coaches, right?
Definitely. One of my coaches, who was a white assistant coach, somebody who I had thought, you know, had my best interest in mind the entire year. You know, once I decided to exercise my own freedom and agency, he wrote me a pretty nasty letter claiming that I had been admitted to Yale simply on the basis of my athletic ability and that I owed the university something. And, you know, what really shocked me is that he made the claim that Yale only admitted black players, black students, if they were athletes.
Yeah. How did you react to that at the time?
You know, at the time, I was angry, I was saddened, I was shocked. But, you know, again, listening to that inner voice, I eventually forgave him. Mm-hmm. You know, I forgave him because I felt like it was a systemic issue. It was a cultural issue. There's so much pressure on coaches for winning. And, you know, the issues of race and gender and class aren't discussed in these contexts. And so I wrote him a letter just asking him to rethink, you know, his letter, and, you know, and I just wished him well. And to this day, you know, I hope that our conversations and interactions have sort of changed him for the better.
You know, Onaje, there's such an interesting sort of dichotomy at the heart of your story, because the sort of power of the court early in your life begins with this idea that it's almost an expression of personal identity and freedom. And then you travel in a way to the top, at least in terms of college athletics, which is pretty high up, and the court becomes a kind of prison of expectation because you are a black person. So it's anything but an expression of freedom.
Well, yes. You know, that's the double consciousness. You know, on the one hand, you know, African Americans, we see ourselves through the eyes of others and, you know, the dominant culture. And on the other hand, there's something behind the veil. There's freedom. There's agency. You know, good players don't simply play by the rules, right? Mm-hmm. They don't go to the court to be exploited. And part of the problem with social science and a lot of the literature out there on black masculinity in sports is that they view these young men as simply passive participants in the game, right? And it's ironic because they set aside the subjective experience they have on the court, you know? And so what I try to do is say, yes, you know, there is exploitation, but the lived experience, right, that subjectivity, you know, meaning is important for human beings, and these are human beings creating meaning.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about what you went through writing this book. You spent 4 years studying street basketball in Boston. So in a sense, you came back home. You interviewed dozens of young men. What brought you back? I mean, what made you want to write the book?
Yeah, so it was a healing process for me. It really was. I felt survivor's guilt, you know, after leaving Roxbury and entering the Ivy League. In order to do that, I had to leave my community behind in many ways. You know, I was entering a culture which was so different from theirs. And so for me to return, it gave me a sense of wholeness. You know, I was able to see people and to mourn with people and to ask for forgiveness, you know, for people who I left behind. The first, really one of the first interviews I had was with a young man named Shorty, and he was a god to me growing up. You know, the way that he dribbled the ball, he dribbled over his head. In the NBA would have been a travel, you know, but he had this street ball style that was just uncanny. And I just, watching him mesmerized me as a child, and I thought he would go into the NBA. And I hadn't heard about him for years. And so one of these days I went back to Roxbury as I was writing the book, and I saw him on the court, and he still moved with the grace, you know, of a ballerina out there. And but what was so striking is that when I approached him, he couldn't look me in the eye. And I later found out that he had just been released from prison, and he was there to mourn his grandmother who died while he was in prison with his jump shot.
Oh boy.
And, you know, I talked to him for hours and we played together. And, you know, it just taught me so much about how young men are using the game to create meaning.
And if they do that successfully, it can be a truly transcendent sort of experience for them, right?
Certainly, yes. You know, in the streets, you know, your ego is so wrapped up in the violence and the distractions. Part of what ritual does, and the ritual of basketball does, it gives you a moment to place that assumption or that identity in abeyance, right? You can bracket it for a moment in time and look at it and see yourself, you know, and rework some of those things. And so it is a kind of transcendent experience. And, you know, oftentimes at the end of the game, if the ritual is really going well, there'll be this cathartic moment where they just let it all out. And sometimes there are witnesses on the sidelines that see those qualities in them. And it's just an amazing experience.
Anajay Woodbine. He's the author of Black Gods of the Asphalt, Religion, Hip Hop, and Street Basketball. He also teaches philosophy and religious studies at Phillips Academy in Andover. We spoke to him back in May of 2016. Stay with us. There's more coming up. We're going to look at the Boston premiere of Stronger, about Boston Marathon bombing survivor Jeff Bowman. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. So here's a clip from a new movie about surviving the Boston Marathon bombing called Stronger, which opens nationally next Friday.
There was an explosion, and your legs, they're gone, bro.
Stronger tells the story of Jeff Bowman, a young man from Chelmsford who was on Boylston Street watching the Boston Marathon on April 15th, 2013, when the first bomb exploded just a few feet from him. Three people died on Boylston Street that day, and more than 260 were injured, many of them horribly, like Jeff, who lost both his legs. Jeff eventually recovered and wrote a memoir called Stronger, on which the new film is based. It was shown for the first time in the U.S. last night at the Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital in Boston. WBUR's Alex Ashlock was there for the Boston premiere, and he's in the studio now. Alex, good to have you.
Good afternoon, Anthony.
So tell us, why Spalding for the first U.S. showing of Stronger?
Well, you know, it really made perfect sense because Spalding is a huge part of Jeff Bowman's story. Also, 31 other Boston Marathon bombing survivors who were injured that day, they received treatment at Spalding. They filmed scenes on the third floor gym where Jeff Bowman and these other folks did much of their very difficult rehab work. So in a way, showing the film there was a way to thank the staff for everything they've done. I spoke to Dr. David Storto. He's president of Spalding Rehab.
It's a great opportunity for Spalding to help further its mission of educating the public about the challenges of people with disabilities. That's why we're doing this. This is obviously not an everyday event for a hospital, but when we were approached and we thought that we'd be able to carry it off without really disrupting the patient care and making sure that they could get care in other ways, we thought, why not? This would be consistent with what we're all about, to educate the public.
Interesting. So, Alex, what was it like for the staff at Spalding to see this movie? What was the reaction?
Anthony, it was really gratifying. There were hugs all around. You could see that it meant a lot for the folks from the movie to come back, including Jeff Bowman and the stars of the movie, to come back to the hospital for the screening of the film. David Crandell, Jeff Bowman's doctor while he was rehabbing at Spalding, joked that there haven't been any other movies made about any of his patients before, so this was really special. But he also gave credit to other parts of the Boston medical community who responded so well to the bombing that day.
Fortunately, and in Jeff's case, he got, resuscitation at the scene. He got to Boston Medical Center where the surgical teams were ready, right? He had a great surgeon in Jeff Kalish, and literally he got the care that he needed so that when he came here to Spalding, he really was in a great position to make a good recovery. So a lot of all the hard work, it's not like he didn't do hard work here, but a lot of the hard work was done even before he came.
So a lot of the hard work done before he came, but obviously a lot of hard work done by Jeff Bowman himself and the staff at Spalding. So how does the film depict the work that Jeff Bowman did there?
It shows those scenes in the hospital. It shows him doing these exercises, trying to get stronger. He works with his prosthetic legs. He walks on them for the first time. But it really is realistic about this as well. It also shows how difficult it was. He doesn't show up for appointments. He's not really committed to doing it. He feels sorry for himself in a way. Very tough mentally and physically. There's a scene, it's really hard to watch, where the dressings on his legs are removed for the first time. It's agonizing. I had to look away. I couldn't watch it. But now, that's a few years ago. Jeff was there last night, and here's what he had to say about being back in the hospital.
You know, it's really great to see everybody that I spent so much time with. Over a year and a half, I was here as an outpatient coming here, and they did their job, even though I fought them tooth and nail. But they did. The PT, Michelle Kerr, is here. She did her job. That's what it's all about.
Michelle Kerr is one of the Spalding staff members who helped him with his physical therapy, and last night Jeff had a chance to reunite with her and others who helped him at the hospital. They were invited to the screening.
Mm. So this has been quite a journey for Jeff Bowman. He's really been the public face of what's come to be known as Boston Strong. But this isn't something that just happened to Jeff. It's also been very difficult for his friends and family, right?
Yeah, it's been tough for everyone. Obviously, he lost his legs, but there's sort of an orbit of people around him that were also affected. The film really digs into this part of the story, especially his relationship with Erin Hurley, his on-again, off-again girlfriend. She played a huge role taking care of him after the bombings, along with his family, of course. They had a daughter, Nora, together. They're co-parenting her now because actually they're no longer together as a couple. But Erin was there last night to support Jeff, and here's what she had to say.
I'm a little nervous just because of the nature of everything, but, you know, overall, I'm really proud of the movie that they made, and obviously I have a lot of worries about, you know, Nora when she gets older and watches the movie, but overall, you know, I'm very, very happy to be here and happy to support Jeff and the project that he undertook.
And Anthony, remember, Jeff was there on Boylston Street in 2013 to watch Erin finish the marathon. That's when the bombs went off, of course. She eventually did finish the race in 2016. Jeff was there on his prosthetic legs at the finish line to greet her.
Yeah, and of course, a very powerful and emotional moment there. Alex, before I let you go, you've been covering the marathon for years. You've covered the aftermath of the bombing that day, some of the other movies, books, and documentaries made about it. How are you thinking about where we are as a city more than 4 years after that attack?
Yeah, you mentioned Boston Strong. I think there are people who think of that as sort of an empty sentiment. Something to chant at the ball game, and I get that, but it has a lingering meaning. And I was thinking about this as I watched yesterday another man with two prosthetic legs at Spalding, not Jeff Bowman. There's no movie about his life, no one coming up to him and saying, can I take a picture with you? He was just somebody who needed help. He was getting it at Spalding, just like Jeff did. So I think 4 years later, the legacy of all this is just this appreciation of showing up, doing your job, taking one step after another, because as we know now, if we didn't know before, everything about your life can change in the blink of an eye.
That's for sure. WBUR's Alex Ashlock, who was at last night's screening of Stronger, the story of Jeff Bowman, which opens in Boston across the nation a week from this coming Friday. Alex, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So lately, the Cleveland Indians know how to do just one thing really well. Win.
Swings at the first pitch and a line drive to left field. Caught by Lonnie Chisenhall. It's over. 21 in a row. The Cleveland Indians have set a new record for the longest win streak in American League history.
That's right, and that call came just this afternoon. Right as our show was getting started, the Indians beat the Detroit Tigers 5-3, setting a new American League record, 21 consecutive wins. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, he joins us now as he does most Wednesdays, and he's with us. Bill, what do you think? 21 in a row.
21 in a row. It's not supposed to happen that way in baseball, is it?
No, it really isn't. You have a 3-game winning streak, a 4-game. You win 6 of your last 7, but
yep.
21 in a row.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, and all of the praise of the Indians, I think, is absolutely and thoroughly justified. And I couldn't be happier for their manager, Terry Francona, who did a stretch here in Boston, most of which was also very successful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was reading a piece of the New York Times by Tyler Kepner, and they quoted, I think, a member of the coaching staff who explained the win streak. He said two words, Terry Francona.
Well, that may be a little oversimplified. The interesting thing about this, and it's not surprising, I suppose, but if you look at the string of games, they won games 11-2, you know, 10-whatever, so they could hit like crazy. They also won a lot of games 3-2, 2-0, scores like that. This was just an example, and I shouldn't speak of it in the past tense because who knows, they may win again. They may stretch their streak next time they play. But it really is an example of a team firing on all cylinders, really everything
is
working well. And it's very exciting. And boy, if you're going to have a winning streak, why not put it together halfway through September?
Yeah, really a good time to do that. So here are two fun facts from Sports Illustrated. The Indians have defeated their opponents by a combined score of 139-5 over the 21-game winning streak. And here's one more. Cleveland has trailed for only 5 innings during their winning streak. So I can't do the math, but 21 times 9, what, that's 180, 190 innings. They've trailed by only 5 of those innings. Amazing. So so that's the big winning streak. There's a bit of a losing streak we need to talk about. Less than 3 weeks ago, the Dodgers were 91-36 amidst talk of being one of the best teams in baseball. Then they lost 11 games in a row until
right.
last night. They managed to win. But 11 games in a row, what went wrong there?
Almost everything.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the year that the Baltimore Orioles won the World Series, and then the next year they were last.
Yeah.
And NPR sent me down to the dugout to ask what went wrong. Nice assignment, huh? And the manager of the Orioles at that point said, well, it's simple. Last year, everything that could go right went right, and this year, everything that could go wrong went wrong. The interesting thing about the Dodgers, though, is that by winning what would have been their 12th loss in a row if they hadn't won, they clinched a place in the playoffs.
Bizarre.
They were so far ahead in their division that all they had to do after losing 11 games was win one.
That's amazing.
To make sure that they would be in the postseason.
So they'll be in the playoffs, and they're still in first place in the National League.
They're still 93-52. It would be, if you looked at any other team, 93-52. The Red Sox would be delighted to be 93-52 at this point.
That's true. And we're going to talk about the Red Sox in a moment, but one more question about these two streaks. So as you said about the Indians, great time in the year to have a 21-game winning streak. For the Dodgers, even though they're still in a pretty good situation, not a great time in the year to have an 11-game losing streak.
Yeah, I like to imagine that in the Dodgers clubhouse, the conversation goes something like this. Hey, remember when we were really good? Because I think we can do it again.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be, let's see if we can find what we were doing before that streak. And we'll see. I mean, 93 wins at this point in the season is still quite an achievement. One of the most interesting things about the standings as you look at them at this point is how many divisions feature teams that are so far ahead. The Dodgers, obviously, were so far ahead they could lose 11 games in a row and still be 10 games ahead. The Astros, 14 games ahead in their division. Hmm. The aforementioned Indians, 13.5 games ahead in their division.
It's not fair. Like, they need to win 21 games in a row.
Well,
come on.
They got to be 13.5 games ahead by doing that. But the point is, it's a darn good thing there are all these wild card spots. The Nationals, 20
yeah.
games ahead in their division. It's a darn good thing there are these wild card spots, or the season, the drama would have been drained from the season some time ago.
All right, well, I want to ask you about the Red Sox. They're in first place in the American League East. Not a huge gap in front of the Yankees. They're 4 games ahead of the Yankees. They look like they have a pretty good chance of getting to the playoffs, even winning the American League East. But what do you see for them in the postseason?
Well, if the regular season is useful as a predictor, I don't see great success for the Red Sox, because you look at the Astros, you look at the Indians, and you say, wow, how do you beat teams that win that consistently? But what history has demonstrated is that if you get there, anything can happen. And if you and I had half an hour instead of just a few minutes, we could talk about all the teams that have stumbled into the postseason and then won the World Series, because it's happened lots and lots of times. So, you know, you never give up. The way that baseball is set up now, your goal is to get to the postseason, presumably with a team that's entertaining and fun to watch and all the rest of it, but to get to the postseason. And once you get there, you try and get your pitching in order, because that's when pitching is obviously most important, and then you cross your fingers and hope for the best.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty much all I feel about the Red Sox. Cross your fingers and hope for the best, and hope that they hit that postseason during a good streak rather than a bad one. Really quickly, the New England Patriots, there was talk about them being undefeated this season. They had that disastrous opening game against the Kansas City Chiefs. What do you think? Are they gonna pull it back, get their game back in order?
Well, unfortunately, the fellow who wasn't listening to all that talk about the undefeated season was a guy named Kareem Hunt, who's a running back at Kansas City, and he had the game of a lifetime against the Patriots. Somebody hadn't warned New England about how good this particular running back could be. Also caught 2 touchdown passes. No, it's a long season. Even a short season for football is a long season. At the end of the first week, you can't really conclude anything. And who knows, maybe this fires everybody up to win the next 15.
All right. That's Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs right here on WBUR Saturdays at 7 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. Bill, thanks. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure, Anthony.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.